afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, a world-class dancer and fiddle player from the show A Taste of Ireland. Then the conductor of the California Symphony talks about their new season of concerts and a throwback interview with singer-songwriter David Archuleta. Today's show is about good sounds and good vibes. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with me, Janae Darden. Recently, the Sights and Sound team and my KLW colleagues got to welcome two young, talented artists from Ireland. They're performing in the dance show A Taste of Ireland, which has been on stage, off Broadway, and at the West End. The world-class artists in this production put a modern twist on Irish music, dance, and songs. They're currently making stops in Northern California during their U.S. tour, and you can see them tomorrow at the Fox Theater in Redwood City, on Friday at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts in Santa Rosa, and at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium on October 5th. Gavin Shevlin is an international dance champion, and Megan McGinley is an award-winning fiddle player. They both have performed in Michael Flatley's Lord of the Dance. They are so talented. I spoke with them at KALW's downtown venue. Gavin Shevlin and Megan McGinley, welcome.
How are
you?
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome to San Francisco. Welcome to the U.S. Welcome to Cali, California. So how's the U.S. tour going?
Yeah, it's going well. So we started in the UK and Ireland in August, and then we came out a few weeks ago, and it's been going well. The crowds are enjoying it, which is the main thing, and we're getting going now in California.
So yeah, I mean, just definitely the music and the dance, we love that here in the U.S. I mean, it's loved around the world, you know, and you both are so talented. And I want to know a little more how you got into this art form. Megan, you're an award-winning musician. You toured with Michael Flatley's Lord of the Dance, the legendary Michael Flatley, and you toured across the U.K. Now, you won like a youth award for how talented you were. How old were you when you toured with Michael Flatley?
I was just out of college, so I was 22.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And I know that has to be a dream for a lot of artists.
Yeah, well, it was never really something I thought about that much. But once I did it, it was just an amazing experience. So yeah, I'm really grateful that I got to do it.
Wow.
I just did 6 weeks in their UK tour.
Yeah, but just to still be able to do it. So when I was growing up, I used to watch Michael Flatley dance on PBS, public broadcasting here in the U.S. So when I read that, I was like, wow, okay. I was like, go ahead, Megan. So you have the fiddle runs in your family, I understand. So tell us about the history in your family of the fiddle and how you began playing.
Yeah, so my great-grandfather, his name was Joe Jack, and he used to play the fiddle. It was kind of at a time where not many musicians lived in our area. I'm from a small place called Gweedore in Donegal. I don't know if you've ever heard of Enya. Do you know the singer Enya?
Mm-mm.
No, she's a really famous singer, but her, yeah, she's from Gweedore, where I'm from.
So some people here, I'm sorry, some of my coworkers are here in the audience watching, so they know who Enya is.
If you know this song Orinoco Flow or Sail Away, those songs.
Oh, she's, okay. I don't
sing. So her father and my great grandfather were like probably two musicians that were kind of only playing in our area, so they used to have loads of music in their houses and stuff. And then my granny and her siblings used to kind of sing and play a few instruments. And then my auntie and uncle started a music school in my area. So I went there and I tried like every instrument, but I decided to stay with the fiddle. So me and my cousin, we both play the fiddle.
Wow. Yeah. So it was just calling you.
Yeah. I love it now.
That's really, really cool. What do you love about that instrument, the fiddle?
Well, Donegal is where our county is really well known for its fiddle playing, and a lot of it is brought over from Scotland, the music that we play, because a lot of people from Donegal used to work in Scotland and then bring the tunes back over and kind of make them a certain way. And it's just great. I love it. We're very different to like the rest of Ireland and kind of our style and playing and everything. So I love being from Donegal. I love everything to do with just Irish culture. And yeah, I just love the fiddle.
So what's different about the way that you play it in the part of the country where you're from in Ireland? You say it's different than Gweedore than other places.
I'd say we're quite fast in how we play, and it's like kind of fiery. It's very heavy handed with our bow in hand. Whereas like down in Kerry, even the kind of music we play, because it came over from Scotland, we play a lot of Highlands or Mazurkas and Strathspeys, which are very Scottish influenced, whereas down the countries they play a lot of like polkas and slides. And then kind of even just the county below in Sligo, it's a lot tamer and just a lot more smooth. And it's just, there's all different kind of ways of playing all over Ireland. But yeah, Donegal would definitely be kind of the roughest, like in the way they play, but it's still good music. It's still nice.
Okay, so y'all, so you really like
get into it, yeah.
Have you heard of a fiddler named Alistair Fraser?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I interviewed him.
Oh no way!
Yeah,
oh,
yes.
Brilliant. Yeah, he's amazing.
He lives in San Francisco or in the Bay Area.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I hope we're talking about the same Alistair Fraser.
Yeah.
Yeah, I interviewed him a couple of months ago. So Gavin, you're a 2-time world champion in dancing, and you have other titles in Ireland and in the UK. So what led you to dancing?
So I actually have a twin sister. She's a dancer as well. She started before me when we were younger. I used to go and like sit with my mum in the class and not dance. And then they needed a boy for like a ceilidh dance, so like a team dance. Mm-hmm. And I got up and done it. And so that's kind of how I got roped into it. But I've been doing it now ever since. So I was 5, so I'm 28 now. But I'm so glad I stuck at it. And
yeah.
Got me a lot of great opportunities.
Where did you look at it like, I can do that?
Well, at the start when I was younger, I was thinking, you know, there's a lot of girls there, not a lot of boys.
Right.
So at the start, I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want it. But then I got into it, and then I really enjoyed it and loved it. And
how were your male friends when you said that you were dancing? Were they supportive, or were they kind of teasing you? Or?
Well, my friends and all, they were supportive. But then as I got older, you know, it's not the most popular thing for a boy to be doing. So like in secondary school and stuff, there was a bit of teasing, but nothing I couldn't manage. But yeah, my friends were all very supportive, so it was good. At the start, they'd say they were a bit like, what are you doing that for?
Yeah.
But yeah.
I was like, that takes a lot of strength. That's why I don't understand why people tease men about dancing, because it takes a whole lot of strength. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with fiddle player Megan McGinley and dancer Gavin Shelvin. They're performing in A Taste of Ireland tomorrow at the Fox Theater in Redwood City, on Friday at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts in Santa Rosa, and in Santa Cruz October 5th. So they're going to be in California for a little while. I kind of want to talk about the history of these art forms. So Megan, you studied Irish music at the University of Limerick, is
mm-hmm.
that I say it right? So what's some important history that you think we should know about Irish music and the fiddle in particular? Something that maybe a lot of us Americans don't know?
Yeah, well, something is that years ago, because it, like in Irish music, it's an oral tradition. It used to be passed on by ear. Kind of collectors would go around and collect music from different musicians. Music was kind of created for, you know, kings or rulers and stuff like that. So they would go around and collect music and put it into the book. But we didn't have any recordings, obviously, of music. But a lot of Irish people came to America. And there was a few people, kind of like Michael Coleman. He was a fiddle player from Sligo. And they became police officers over here. And they actually recorded the first kind of Irish music that was then sent home. And they would then learn it from that. So that's also where the kind of different styles come from as well. So like he was a Sligo fiddle player, so that's how people thought everyone in Sligo kind of played. And so yeah, a lot of musicians who moved over here, there was a few that got to record Irish music for the first time, and then we finally got it at home in Ireland, and that's how we kind of learnt music as well.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. Now, how long ago was that? Do you call like
the 20s, I think?
The 1920s?
Yeah,
oh, yeah. Okay, wow, that's interesting.
Kinda, yeah, 20s, around that time, yeah.
And what about you, Gavin, as far as with dance? Is there any particular piece of history, or maybe if there's anything about the dance that you want to tell us?
So like competition dancing. So years ago, like when Irish dancing, before river dancing, Lord of the Dance, Irish dancing was just, you had to be stand up straight and put your arms by your side, and then your feet would go really fast.
Mm-hmm.
So ever since like Michael Flatley came along, he started using his arms and stuff. So now in a lot of the professional shows, that people use their arms more often, which I think is a good thing. But it's very hard to go from, because I was a competition dancer for years, and then when I was about 18, 19, going into the show dancing, it was very hard to move your arms as well as your feet at the same time. But
we see, so it's evolved. Now, you two are both young. Are you in your 20s?
I'm 25.
Yeah. Okay, so 25, 28. Yeah. Are younger people even being improvising and doing other different things with that traditional Irish dancing? Like, is it evolving? Like, putting a remix to it? Y'all putting a remix on it?
When I suppose as dancing is moving forward and stuff, like, even when Megan was on about, like, musicians going to America and stuff, I'd say it's the same with Irish dancing. Like, cause if some of the rhythms and patterns with like tap dancing and Irish dancing are similar, like even the shoes I have now has like a tap and like an aluminium tip.
Yes, I see.
Normally an Irish dancing shoe is fiberglass tip, so I use that there. But yeah, I know a boy, he's from Ottawa, and he's an Ottawa Valley tap.
Okay.
And He's a very interesting dancer. You should look it up. Look it up. Ottawa Valley.
Okay.
Tap. But a lot of the beats that he does is the same as Irish dancing.
Okay.
The same tap. So I find it interesting. So like I say, when people years ago went over to America and Canada and they brought things back and, you know. But I would say Irish dancing's a lot more modern now. Like, and if you go to the competitions today, like the World Championships, as say 10, 15 years ago, the dancers are, you can tell they're a lot stronger and they're, yeah.
Okay, so it is. I like when I see younger people like bringing like new elements to traditional art form. So that's really cool. And speaking of which, let's talk too about the show that you're doing with A Taste of Ireland. So what can people expect? I know there's live singing and dancing, storytelling, all kind of stuff. So tell us more. I haven't seen it. So for folks that haven't seen it, tell us.
So it's basically the history of Ireland, kind of from the mythological stories. Can I ever say that word? So from Finn McCool and
mythological.
That one.
Yeah.
Those kind of stories at the beginning, and then there's a story as well, Children of Lear, which is a well-known story from Ireland, and then kind of goes through when the Vikings came into Ireland and the famine, 1916 rising, and it's all done through music and dance, so it has its highs and lows, but it's a good show.
Okay. And is there like a tap dance battle? Are they doing in this show? I know they did in the past.
They do
show.
That in Riverdance. Yeah, they do the Irish dancers against the tap.
Yeah.
But no, we don't do that in this show. But I love that number. I was on Riverdance before and I danced that number. But when I remember when I was younger, I went and seen that and it was.
Yeah,
I was like,
cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
But, yeah, but we do a lot of like different dance offs. Like there's a part where all the boys come on stage and kind of like show off.
Oh, I love that.
It's good. We can kind of have a bit of fun when we're doing that as well. And then the audience gets on board with that as well. And you can tell when we're having fun, the audience is having fun, and they kind of get in on the jokes as well. I like that number. But there's, yeah.
How many people are in A Taste of Ireland?
There's about, I'd say around 25 to 30. There's about 16 dancers, two musicians, a singer.
Well, I'm excited for people who are going to see it, because like I said, I've seen some clips of it. And just to tell the audience that's listening, they look fabulous. they came and they dressed up for us here. And I'm looking at Megan. Megan has on this really cute like jumpsuit, and it's green. It's like this rich green, and it's black and with sequins on it and heels. And Gavin, you have on a nice tux, and it's with the white jacket and the black shirt. So we want people to get the visuals of how handsome you both look. I'm excited. I'm excited for you. First of all, y'all, I'm always excited when young people do great things. So I'm excited for you that you had this opportunity to perform and that you'll be, you know, you're touring here. I'm excited for you for the show. And I'm excited because you all are going to give us a sample. We're gonna get a taste of of Ireland. So I thank you so much for talking to me, and
thanks for having us on.
Yeah, and come back anytime, and I look forward to see what the demo you're gonna give us. So
thanks very
much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
so much fun. That was dancer Gavin Shevlin and fiddle player Megan McGinley. See them in A Taste of Ireland tomorrow at the Fox Theater in Redwood City, on Friday at the Luther Burbank Center for the Arts in Santa Rosa, and at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium on October 5th. We'll have a link on our website so you can see where they'll be throughout California. They're traveling all over the place. But make sure to visit KALW's Instagram page to see Gavin and Megan perform at KALW. And coming up, some classical music from the California Symphony and some good conversation. Stay with us. Listening to the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Fall is a busy time in the arts community, in part because that's when so many new shows are coming to audiences. It's a busy time for the Sights and Sounds crew, too. Anyway, but the California Symphony is kicking off their new season this weekend, and the show is called Pictures from Paris, and it includes compositions by, and I hope I'm saying his name right, Maurice Ravel, George Gershwin, and Modeste Mussorgsky. You can enjoy the concert at the Lesher Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek, and here to tell us more is the artistic and music director of the California Symphony, the maestro himself, Mr. Donato Cabrera. Hey, Donato.
Hey, Janae. It's so great to be here.
It's so good to see you. We've communicated, so you're here in studio in person. It's my first time meeting you in person, so yeah. So
I'm excited.
I'm excited, too. Before we even get into the symphony, I heard you had a good summer.
I did. I got really lucky. I had the opportunity to see some friends get married who I've known as a couple for a decade. They got married in Tuscany.
Wow.
So it was like a storybook wedding. And I rented a car and I puttered around Tuscany. Hopefully I didn't get any speeding tickets, but I got to visit them. And then I was in Vienna for a couple of weeks as well. And I, at the end of the summer, I got to go to the Telluride Film Festival, which I've been to a few times.
Okay.
Another Bay Area friend of mine who's since passed away, Tom Luddy, who's the founder of the Telluride Film Festival, he invited me to it years ago, and I've been a fan of this film festival ever since. So it was a really inspiring summer. Not that much music, but a lot of lovely artistic inspiration.
Yeah, I was wondering. I said, I'm sure that inspires you as an artist.
Absolutely.
I had to ask you that because I know you travel a lot. So I was like, where did Donato go this summer? That's why I had to ask you. All right, so you know, take that mental picture of y'all to Tuscany, because I know I did, to help me relax. I was mentally there with you. Okay, since we're talking about Europe and the theme for the upcoming show, you're kicking off this weekend, the season, 25-26 season. The show is called Pictures from Paris. So you had me at Paris. So tell us about this thing. Why Pictures from Paris?
Well, it has a lot to do with the repertoire we're performing. The main piece on the program, the big second half piece, is this piece that was originally written for piano by the Russian composer Modeste Mussorgsky, Pictures at an Exhibition.
Okay.
But then the French composer Maurice Ravel orchestrated it for orchestra, which means he took this piano piece and he reimagined it for the sounds of a symphony orchestra. And this is such a great and unique skill, and not a lot of composers will do that with another composer's mm-hmm. piece, take a piano piece and make it into an orchestra piece. But Ravel did that a lot, and he was really good at it. And he did this in the early 20s, premiered with the Boston Symphony, but was written in Paris. And then we begin the program with Maurice Ravel's most famous piece, Bolero, and probably people know Bolero mm-hmm. from the movie 10 in the 1970s, and Torval and Dean at the 84 Olympics, they got their gold medal doing ice dancing to Bolero.
Nice.
So we begin the program with this piece, which people know and love. And then that's followed in the first half by George Gershwin's An American in Paris.
Which is a classic.
And again, most people know of that from the 1951 mm-hmm. movie with Gene Kelly. But that was also written in the 1920s because George Gershwin went to study with Maurice Ravel.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's actually a really funny story. So he goes, he's already a world famous composer, writing for Broadway, but he wants to start writing classical music. And mm-hmm. so he goes to the most famous living classical composer around, which is Maurice Ravel. And he goes and Maurice receives him. And Ravel's a little confused. And he asks George, he's like, well, how much money did you make last year composing? And George tells him, he said, you know, I think I should be studying composition with you.
making the money.
And so I don't think you need my help. I mean, I'm flattered, but just go and write symphonic music from the music you know. So if you hear an American, so he goes back to New York, he writes his experience of being in an American being in Paris using jazz rhythms, Broadway rhythms, yeah, and tunes. And Maurice Ravel was right on the money. He let Gershwin be himself. And that's what making music is all about.
And that's nothing when you let an artist. There's nothing like telling an artist just to be yourself.
That's right.
And I want to go back to something you said that struck me. So you said Ravel took Mussorgsky's song and made it into an orchestra piece.
That's
and
right.
I was thinking, so it went from piano to orchestra.
Yeah.
That has to be very hard or challenge. Is that, I mean, to take a piano piece and turn it to
I think what it requires is, you know, if you hear the original composition, which is, it's the same exact length, give or take, than what you would normally hear with the orchestra version, and most people know Ravel's version. They don't necessarily know the original piano version, but if you listen to the original piano version, you are amazed that you just hear the piano part, but Ravel heard a trumpet with these notes. And then on the next movement, he heard the woodwind section playing that. And it's just ingenious. It just requires a great imagination, and Ravel had that. And I think that he makes this piece in the 3D when he makes it an orchestra piece.
That's an interesting analogy.
Most composers write, all the famous composers, whether it was Beethoven or Mozart, most of them composed their music at the piano, and they created what would be called a piano score. And then from the piano score, they would then make it into an orchestral piece. So he's sort of doing what composers do anyway, but just with another composer's music.
Ah, okay, got it. Okay. Yeah. I told Donato, I said, please take me to school when you come here. Because I'm not a classical music expert. I do listen to it, but I'm not an expert. So when you break it down like that, okay, that makes sense. Because to me, that seemed really big.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And it's really impressive that someone can do that. But it's just like when a singer-songwriter like Paul McCartney, you see the documentary or whatever of him sitting at the piano or with his bass, he's teaching everyone else the tune that he's written, or John Lennon does that. It's the same concept, but just with a little bit more instruments involved.
Okay.
Same idea.
Okay, so that makes sense. Well, tell us about these composers, you know, because one of the things I like about classical music, or what I've learned about classical music, is there's the stories behind the composers and behind the songs. So you gave us some information, like about An American in Paris, but I want to learn more about, and I'm struggling with his name, Mussorgsky. Can you tell
That's
us?
That's really good.
Okay. I'm working
really good
on it. Like I said, this is a classical music school with Janae Donato. but tell me more about him and what's unique about him as an artist, or what was unique about him as an artist?
I think one of the main things we have when I was learning about Modest Mussorgsky was that he was a man that was plagued with alcoholism. Was something that he struggled with his whole life. And he, during the good times, he was a very prolific composer and was very concerned about creating a Russian national identity in music, because at the time, you know, there was German music, everyone knew about Beethoven, and there was a French sound, and in the late 19th century, Russians were becoming more aware of who they were as a culture. And so there was a movement in not just music, but in art and poetry and in novel and in writing, to create a Russian school, a Russian sensibility in the arts. And Mussorgsky was part of that movement, as well as this painter, Victor Hartmann, who he greatly admired. And Hartmann passed away in 1873, I believe, and they had an exhibit of his paintings. Of course, Mussorgsky went to this exhibit because he was one of his good friends, and he was so inspired that he wrote this piece, Pictures at an Exhibition, meaning of going to an exhibition of his friend's work.
Oh.
And so I think the main thing to know about Mussorgsky is he was primarily mostly concerned about creating a Russian national identity. And a lot of his works, were also left unfinished because he had this struggle with his addiction, and a lot of his colleagues helped finish the works that he left unfinished after he passed away, which kind of sometimes sanitized his very raw music making. And when you go back and you start listening to his music in its original form, you get to hear who he was really like.
So people, when they performed his music, they kind of diluted it a little bit?
Well, when Rimsky-Korsakov, this is another Russian composer, he edited his friend's music, mm-hmm. and sort of changed things, sanitized it. Not in a bad way. He had all good intentions.
Okay.
But some of these original harmonies and corners in his music were real raw and rough-edged, and he tried to smooth them out, thinking that, well, maybe he didn't really mean that, but he did.
Ah.
And so when you hear, like, the original version of Night on Bald Mountain, which is a very famous piece by Mussorgsky that was used in the movie Disney's Fantasia,
mm-hmm.
If you hear the original version, it's even scarier than the Night on Bald Mountain we normally know, which is Rimsky-Korsakov's version.
Okay.
So that's what I mean by that.
See, I like it edgy.
If
you want it edgy, be edgy. And let him be edgy.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
Who he was, and that's what he was feeling at the time. Well, let's play a song. So here is Mussorgsky, a piece from him, by him, well, one of his pieces, by the California Symphony, and the song is called Limoges.
Limoges,
okay,
yes.
Okay, which is a city in central France.
That's right. If you can imagine that the painting, Hartmann's mm-hmm. painting of Limoges, is of the marketplace. And it's all the hustle and bustle of people trying to buy flowers and the eggs and the freshest produce.
Yeah.
And it's just this wonderful painting of just life in Limoges in the marketplace on any given morning. And Mussorgsky originally wrote it for piano wonderfully, but you can this 3D version of Ravel, you can really hear that hustle and bustle.
I'm thinking of this, the farmer's market by the ferry building.
Yeah,
yeah,
same thing.
Like,
it's crazy.
Kind of like, right? If you're just joining me, I'm chatting with conductor Donato Cabrera. He is the artistic and music director of the California Symphony. Their new season kicks off this Saturday and Sunday with the show Pictures from Paris, and you can experience the music at the Lesher Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek. I wish you all could see Donato while the music was playing. He was in the zone. His head was moving, and then he got really intense. Like, it was certain parts where he was really, really, like, focused and he was catching on to something that I wasn't, because, you know, I'm not a conductor. But it was really a treat just to watch you kind of just lose yourself, you know, in the music. So how do you prepare for a concert like this? You know, you got this concert coming up. How do you prepare for that?
It's a long process. You know, all three pieces I've conducted before. So it's not with a piece that's brand new to me, there's a lot of work I need to do. I learn about you know, if it was composed in 1928, I go and I try and find out about as much as I can about what the composer was experiencing at that time in their lives in 1928. Where were they? What was it like politically in the country that they were in? And so all three pieces are like that. So with Ravel, where was Ravel in 1928 in terms of his career? Was he happy? Why did he write Bolero? Who did he write it for? Most pieces are commissioned by either a group of people or by one individual. In this case, Bolero was commissioned by this eccentric, wonderful personage of 1920s Paris, Ida Rubinstein, who was this very wealthy woman from St. Petersburg who commissioned many famous pieces for her to dance to. And she would rent out the opera house in Paris and do these extravagant one-person shows. And on one of these one-person shows was Bolero. So this huge orchestra was in the pit, and then she was dancing on a table for 15 minutes.
Were there people watching?
Yes, it was. She would rent out the opera, the Paris Opera, and she would put on these extravagant shows. And she was very well known for doing this.
Could she dance? Was she a good dancer?
Well, let's hope so.
Yeah, exactly. I know that.
And so if you can imagine the original performance of Bolero, this is what I think about. This is what informs me about Bolero, not Ravel so much, but most people don't know why it was written and how what it was written for. It was this incredible woman who was dancing on a table in the Paris Opera. That's the original performance of Bolero.
Interesting.
And that's what I think about. Those are things I love to discover.
Yeah. That's why I said I feel like when we learn about classical music, and I don't mean people that have studied it. I feel like just, you know, when it's introduced to us, there's not this context, right?
Right.
I mean, because people that like music, a lot of them, they like music history. And so there's not, they're like, this is Beethoven. I remember when I was in eighth grade when we saw Amadeus. We were a bunch of black kids in East Oakland. That blew our minds because we were like, what? They were acting like that back then?
It humanized. It makes it personal.
Yeah, yeah. And I wish we did that more for young people so they can understand like why this music is so important for those who maybe don't understand.
I think it's very easy to submit, just to imagine these composers or writers, or, you know, you think about Shakespeare 400 years ago, like it's hard not to imagine them as like marble edifices,
right.
But they were
real people. Right.
And they were really writing, composing things to touch people. And it's my goal in life to bring back that context.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I hope you all also learn a lot at Donato's classical music history school. I keep naming it.
I like it. We got to trademark that.
Yeah, we got to trademark that. We have about 2 minutes left, and I definitely wanted to talk to you about how you and the symphony and classical arts are being impacted currently by rules coming from this administration, grants. The rules for grants have changed. You know, we at KLW and other public radio stations, public media has been impacted with our funding being cut. How are you all impacted?
I think, you know, it's happening so quickly that we're really trying our best to think on our feet. What we're coming to the realization and really needing to do this quickly is that we really are now in need of the support of individual donors more than ever. That it really makes a difference if you give to the local arts, you give to public radio. Your contribution makes even more of a difference now, and it's crucial because there's much less government support and organizations that provide grants. That's not as common as it was. So individuals make a huge difference in your community. I mean, it's an age-old story, but it's really crucial now.
And I think what's crucial and important, too, is to go and that, you know, definitely give and support, but also experience the art. Experience it. I know people are stressed out and, you know, and shocked by some of the things happening, and I'm like, go to a show. It's not a cure for everything, but it helps.
Being in community and experiencing art, there's really nothing like that. And yes, it's wonderful to stay at home. I have my Netflix account. I have my Apple. I have all the things, and I love that stuff. But it doesn't supplant that communal experience that we must have to thrive. as humans.
I totally agree with you, Donato. It has been a pleasure.
Always, Janae. Can't wait till the next time.
Next time. There will be a next time. Donato Cabrera is the artistic and music director of the California Symphony. Their new season begins this weekend with the show Pictures from Paris, and that's happening at the Lesher Center for the Arts in Walnut Creek. Next up, a delightful discussion with singer David Archuleta. Keep it locked right here. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. This year, we chatted with a few artists who competed on reality shows. San Francisco's Kat Robichaux was on The Voice years ago. Most recently, Cole Swenson went from Walnut Creek to Hollywood and landed on this season of America's Got Talent. But today, we're revisiting an interview with someone who won over a lot of fans when he competed on American Idol in 2008. And that's David Archuleta. He was just a teenager back then, and a lot has changed in his life. In 2021, he came out as queer and shortly after left the Mormon church. Now the 34-year-old is getting personal and having fun too in his new EP, Earthly Delights. David is performing this Saturday at the Independent in San Francisco. Here's a look back at our interview. Mr. David Archuleta, welcome.
Hello, Janae. Great to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this conversation. Your EP, Earthly Delights, is definitely delightful. So I enjoy listening to it.
Oh, thank you.
And so I know this comes as a time you've been more publicly open about your sexuality, about your desires, some of your fears. That's what I'm getting off this project. How did it feel just to release all of that, that you've been carrying?
It's been really great. Earthly Delights, the reason why it's titled that way even is because I lived a pretty sheltered life and I was encouraged to do so. Like, you know, stay away from the bad world out there and anything that it might get you into, like any trouble or sticky situations. And one of those things that I was always told, you know, believed I needed to stay away from was the LGBTQ plus community. But, you know, kind of feeling deep inside of me, that's like, well, I might be part of that community. So to fear it, but then by being taught to fear it, I was also being taught to fear myself. Then fearing what love could look like for me. Now that I've come out a few years ago, this was something I was always told was like worldly and bad. Like anything that was worldly from a religious standpoint was considered bad. So I'm like, okay, well, it's time to indulge in those worldly things a little bit. And so thus earthly delights. And to me, it's so interesting that it's not the terrible, horrible, worldly thing that I was always told it was. So it's kind of like tongue in cheek as well.
I read recently you performed at several Pride celebrations in the United States this year. And one of them was Utah, right? And that's where you're originally from. Or I know you grew up in Utah. How did it feel to perform at Pride in Utah?
It felt amazing. It was a full circle moment. And a lot of people who were at that Pride had been through a very similar journey as me. So it was like, wow, because I've realized that, yes, the Mormon experience and coming out as queer after being in the Mormon world is a very unique road to take. There are unique cultural influences and nuances that affect life in general, how you perceive things, and unique challenges in being able to come to terms with yourself and accept yourself and come out. So to be with a whole big audience of people who I could see had been through the same thing was just, I was like, this is so cool.
So you came into your own, you came to this album, Earthly Delights, is you're embracing who you are, right? And again, just, you know, your queerness and your desires and things that you were taught that aren't good, but you're seeing the humanness of yourself, right? And you know, you left the Mormon church, I read, because of their stance on homosexuality. And I read in your bio that in your music, you stand up for your beliefs. And you said that that's something you learned growing up in your church. Where did you find that balance of taking with you from the church what works and leaving behind what doesn't? Was that a challenge for you too?
Yeah, I think it takes some experimenting to see, well, does it still serve me, or does this kind of is this now a stumbling block or something that holds me back? So that's why I decided to just leave religion entirely, because I saw that there are a lot of things that give structure to other people and build a sense of community. but there aren't very many queer accepting spaces in religion. And that's just the nature of the beast right now. And if I'm looking for a sense of community, which I think is a godly experience, is to connect with other people. I don't think there's anything more beautiful and spiritual than that. I think it gets a little tricky. You know, it's like I've learned a lot of beautiful things from my faith community growing up. And I'm going to take those things, utilize the skills that it gave me to be empathetic and understanding and question things in life and believe that there is something bigger connecting all of us, but also allow myself to be a more independent thinker.
Yeah, and a lot of people, especially people your age, we're seeing a lot of that because church attendance is down in the United States. So where do you find your spirituality now? I mean, your music, I know for me, listening to music, that gives me so much joy. You mentioned just connecting with people. Is that where you're kind of finding your divinity now?
Yeah, I think connection for me is the most beautiful spiritual experience. And I feel that when I go on walks outside, you just feel present. You feel, and you feel the presence of something that you don't normally pay attention to when you're just going around busy with your day, going to festivals and even going out dancing. It's like you feel the rhythm. Everyone present is also connected to the rhythm. They're dancing to it and listening, and you all feel like you're on the same wavelength. And I just think it's so cool to feel one with people, even if it's for a brief moment, just through a song. And as a performer, being able to provide that experience, like you write, you create, and then you perform it and see everyone in unison, it's a moment where I feel that community and that unity that people used to say was God before. It's like, oh, this is the same feeling. It's just in an environment that looks a little different than a church building or a chapel.
I felt definitely that connection listening to Earthly Delight. The fun, the dancing, the soul. I felt all of that. It's a great EP. And I love all the songs. I have my favorites, of course. Creme Brulee, which is the first single off your EP. And it's a fun pop song with some like Latin flair in there, which I know that's part of your heritage.
Yeah.
Oh no, another man down. Another heart left on the dance floor. Took a bite, now he wants more.
And the video is cute too. And David, y'all, is working it in the video. With the dancing.
Don't care about a main course. One night in the singing my praises. Two shots in the honeymoon phases. Three wood phrases, skipping stages. It's all over your face like, oh no. There goes all of your clothes. Speaking words you don't know. Yo te vuelvo loco.
Thank you. It was so fun with the dancing. It was choreographed by Jaw Collective, and they are just really amazing. They have a unique style of choreography. But yeah, dancing for me is therapeutic. So I'm not a professional dancer, but it just adds a fun element to when you get to move to the music. But yeah, Creme Brulee, I wanted to tap into my Latin roots. I wanted to feel fun pop vibes, to feel flirty. So I call it my flirty era with that song. And singing in Spanish, I just feel like I get a little more flirty when I tap into Spanish. And so that's been really fun. My mom is from Central America. She's from Honduras. And so that's always been a part of my upbringing. So to be able to have some bilingual vibes with English and Spanish in a song has been so fun to play with.
And it's definitely fun and flirty too. It makes you want to flirt. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with singer and former American Idol contestant David Archuleta. His new EP is called Earthly Delights, and you can see him live at the Independent in San Francisco on September 27th, and tickets are on sale now. Okay, so you got some pop stuff going on. I felt a little R&B, David. I felt some R&B from you.
Yeah.
So definitely two of my favorite songs on your EP are Lucky and Home. So coming home, there's this line, loving you is like coming home.
Cause loving you is like coming home. Loving you is like coming home. All these years I've been on my own. But loving you is like coming home.
To me, when I think of love and the kind of love I want, that's what comes to mind is home. You're with someone and you feel like you can be yourself. You're with someone and you feel grounded.
In a world that's harsh, don't have to worry about anyone else. You next to me is the most natural feeling I've known.
So talk about where the idea came from.
For me, I wanted to describe what it felt like to come out. You see a lot of times the breaking free and like you've been in chains and in, like in a cage and now you finally just get to let loose and get wild after all this time. And I think we see a lot of that side of coming out, but a lot of times we don't see what it's like to allow yourself to finally love someone fully and not hold yourself back. So when I came out, I felt like home was the best way to describe to someone else what it feels like to come out. You finally allow yourself to experience what most other people already have the freedom to experience and feel, which is to fall in love. And I wanted it to also be like, you know, it doesn't have to be a romantic song necessarily, because I feel like love is a universal experience. It can be just a community where you found a sense of belonging, or people that we feel safe with.
Your songs, I know this is a queer album and I'm not queer. At the same time, I really connected with the music. So I feel like this is for anybody. I think anybody with a heart, you know, would enjoy this EP. And there's a song that I related to because I'm about to talk about my issues. The song Give You the World. And you sing, I can give you the world, but I'll never give you my heart. And you said staying in love isn't one of your strengths.
I will let you be skin on my skin, but I'd be damned if you ever get in. Cause I won't let you closer than just an arm's length. No, staying in know before we get too far. I could give you the world, but I'll never give you my heart.
And I know for me, now this may be a different reason for you. I know for me, because I've had my heart broken, sometimes it's very hard for me to open my heart. And so I've really related to that song.
The people I let down because they thought I really cared more than I cared, and I mean it, I promise I was never dishonest. I don't try to hurt them, I swear. If you ask for the world, I'd give that and the moon. I would break every bone, I would get you tattooed. I would let you be skin on my skin, but I'd be damned if you ever get in.
Does falling in love still scare you now, or are you, do you feel more, you have more courage than me, David?
Oh my goodness. I'm so happy that you feel, and yes, it's an album that came from me exploring my queer experience and coming out, but in the end, music is universal. It's a universal language. And I'm so glad that even as a straight person can relate to the music. That's the goal. That's the point as an artist, is to make it universal. And the queer experience, I feel like, is relatable, even if you're not queer. And the point is to like give you the world. It's my own personal experience, but I wouldn't say that song necessarily is about this is what it's like to be gay or this is what it's like to be queer. It's just this is what it's like trying to open yourself up and feeling like you fail again and again and again because you don't know how to keep your heart open for someone and not retract and be afraid of someone hurting you. And in the process, you end up hurting other people. And it's like the messy experience of being human.
What does queer joy mean to you?
For me personally, queer joy is learning to love and embrace and like freely shine a part of you that you once had such difficulty revealing because you were so afraid of what could happen if it could harm you for revealing that part of you. And to feel the contrast, I feel like there is this hard to describe joy that comes and this relief. And it is such a liberating experience because it's like, I used to be so used to hiding this part and being ashamed and trying everything I could to suppress it and to mask myself because of how misunderstood queerness is.
David Archuleta, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Janae. Likewise, so good to talk to you.
That was David Archuleta. See him at the Independent in San Francisco this Saturday. And that's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darton. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rango, board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. Thanks to our events coordinator, Charles Lighthouse, and videographer, Dante Jones, for helping with the Taste of Ireland interview. And thank you for tuning in. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other. Thank you.